He did this by photographing a colored bow three times through red, green, and violet filters. Having obtained three color separation images, as he called them, he now brought these together by superimposing them upon a screen, projecting each image through its corresponding filter. The image taken through the red filter was projected with red light, and so on. Suddenly, the bow burst forth in full color. Maxwell wondered if this was how colors were perceived in the brain, by the addition of color separation images, or their neural correlates, as in his magic lantern demonstrations. Maxwell himself was acutely aware of the drawback of this additive process. Color photography had no way of discounting the illuminant, and its colors changed helplessly with changing wavelengths of light. In 1957, 90-odd years after Maxwell's famous demonstration, Edwin Land, not merely the inventor of the instant Land camera and Polaroid, but an experimenter and theorizer of genius, provided a photographic demonstration of color perception even more startling. Unlike Maxwell, he made only two black-and-white images, using a split-beam camera so they could be taken at the same time from the same viewpoint through the same lens, and superimposed these on a screen with a double-lens projector. He used two filters to make the images, one passing longer wavelengths, a red filter, the other passing shorter wavelengths, a green filter. The first image was then projected through a red filter, the second with ordinary white light, unfiltered. One might expect that this would produce just an overall pale pink image, but something impossible happened instead. The photograph of a young woman appeared instantly in full color. Blonde hair, pale blue eyes, red coat, blue-green collar, and strikingly natural flesh tones, as Land later described it. Where did these colors come from? How were they made? They did not seem to be in the photographs or the illuminants themselves. These demonstrations, overwhelming in their simplicity and impact, were color illusions in Goethe's sense, but illusions that demonstrated a neurological truth, that colors are not out there in the world, nor, as classical theory held, an automatic correlate of wavelength, but rather are constructed by the brain. These experiments hung at first like anomalies, conceptless in midair. They were inexplicable in terms of existing theory, but did not yet point clearly to a new one. It seemed possible, moreover, that the viewer's knowledge of appropriate colors might influence his perception of such a scene. Land decided, therefore, to replace familiar images of the natural world with entirely abstract, multicolored displays consisting of geometric patches of colored paper, so that expectation could provide no clues as to what colors should be seen. These abstract displays vaguely resembled some of the paintings of Piet Mondrian, and Land therefore terms them color Mondrians. Using the Mondrians, which were illuminated by three projectors using long wave, red, middle wave, green, and short wave, blue filters, Land was able to prove that if a surface formed part of a complex multicolored scene, there was no simple relationship between the wavelength of light reflected from a surface and its perceived color. If, moreover, a single patch of color, for example, one ordinarily seen as green, was isolated from its surrounding colors, it would appear only as white or pale gray, whatever illuminating beam was used. Thus, the green patch, Land showed, could not be regarded as inherently green, but was in part given its greenness by its relation to the surrounding areas of the Mondrian. Whereas color for Newton, for classical theory, was something local and absolute, given by the wavelength of light reflected from each point, Land showed that its determination was neither local nor absolute, but depended upon the surveying of a whole scene, and a comparison of the wavelength composition of the light reflected from each point with that of the light reflected from its surround. There had to be a continuous relating, a comparison of every part of the visual field with its own surround, to arrive at that global synthesis, Helmholtz's act of judgment. Land felt that this computation or correlation followed fixed formal rules, and he was able to predict which colors would be perceived by an observer under different conditions. He devised a color cube, an algorithm for this, in effect, a model for the brain's comparison of the brightnesses at different wavelengths of all the parts of a complex, multicolored surface. Whereas Maxwell's color theory and color triangle were based on the concept of color addition, Land's model was now one of comparison. He proposed that there were, in fact, two comparisons. First, of the reflectance of all the surfaces in a scene within a certain group of wavelengths, or wave band, in Land's term, a lightness record for that wave band. And second, a comparison of the three separate lightness records for the three wave bands, corresponding roughly to the red, green, and blue wavelengths. This second comparison generated the color. Land himself was at pains to avoid specifying any particular brain site for these operations, and was careful to call his theory of color vision the retinex theory, implying that there might be multiple sites of interaction between the retina and the cortex. If Land was approaching the problem of how we see colors at a psychophysical level by asking human subjects to report how they perceived complex multicolored mosaics and changing illuminations, Samir Zeki, working in London, was approaching the problem at a physiological level by inserting microelectrodes in the visual cortex of anesthetized monkeys and measuring the neuronal potentials generated when they were given colored stimuli. Early in the 1970s, he was able to make a crucial discovery. To delineate a small area of cells on each side of the brain in the pre-striate cortex of monkeys, areas referred to as V4, which seemed to be specialized for responding to color. Zeki called these color-coding cells. Thus, 90 years after Vilbrandt and Verrey had postulated a specific center for color in the brain, Zeki was finally able to prove that such a center existed. 50 years earlier, the eminent neurologist Gordon Holmes, reviewing 200 cases of visual problems caused by gunshot wounds to the visual cortex, had found not a single case of achromatopsia. He went on to deny that an isolated cerebral achromatopsia could occur. The vehemence of this denial, coming from such a great authority, played a major part in bringing all clinical interest in the subject to an end. Zeki's brilliant and undeniable demonstration startled the neurological world, reawakening attention to a subject it had for many years dismissed. Following his 1973 paper, new cases of human achromatopsia began appearing in the literature once again, and these could now be examined with new brain imaging techniques, CAT, MRI, PET, SQUID, etc., not available to neurologists of an earlier era. Now, for the first time, it was possible to visualize in life what areas of the brain might be needed for human color perception. Though many of the cases described had other problems too, cuts in the visual field, visual agnosia, alexia, etc., the crucial lesions seemed to be in the medial association cortex, in areas homologous to V4 in the monkey. It had been shown in the 1960s that there were cells in the primary visual cortex of monkeys, in the area termed V1, that responded specifically to wavelength, but not to color. Zeki now showed in the early 1970s that there were other cells in the V4 areas that responded to color, but not to wavelength. These V4 cells, however, received impulses from the V1 cells, converging through an intermediate structure, V2. Thus, each V4 cell received information regarding a large portion of the visual field. It seemed that the two stages, postulated by Land in his theory, might now have an anatomical and physiological grounding. Lightness records for each wave band being extracted by the wavelength-sensitive cells in V1, but only being compared or correlated to generate color in the color-coding cells of V4. Every one of these indeed seemed to act as a Landian correlator, or a Helmholtzian judge. Color vision, it seemed, like the other processes of early vision, motion depth and form perception, required no prior knowledge, was not determined by learning or experience, but was, as neurologists say, a bottom-up process. Color can indeed be generated experimentally by magnetic stimulation of V4, causing the seeing of colored rings and halos, so-called chromatophenes. But color vision in real life is part and parcel of our total experience, is linked with our own categorizations and values, becomes for each of us a part of our life world, of us. V4 may be an ultimate generator of color, but it signals to, it converses with, 100 other systems in the mind-brain. And perhaps it can also be modulated by these. It is at higher levels that integration occurs, that color fuses with memories, expectations, associations, and desires to make a world with resonance and meaning for each of us. Mr. I not only presented a rather pure case of cerebral achromatopsia, virtually uncontaminated by additional defects in the perception of form, motion, or depth, but was a highly intelligent and expert witness as well, one who was skilled at drawing and reporting what he saw. Indeed, when we first met, and he described how objects and surfaces fluctuated in different lights, he was, so to speak, describing the world in wavelengths, not in colors. The experience was so unlike anything he had ever experienced, so strange, so anomalous, that he could find no parallels, no metaphors, no paints or words to depict it. When I phoned Professor Zecchi to tell him of this exceptional patient, he was greatly intrigued and wondered, in particular, how Mr. I might do with Mondrian testing, such as he and Land had used with normally sighted people and with animals. He at once arranged to come to New York to join us. Bob Wasserman, my ophthalmologist colleague, Ralph Siegel, a neurophysiologist, and myself, in a comprehensive testing of Jonathan I. No patient with achromatopsia had ever been examined in this way before. We used a Mondrian of great complexity and brilliance, illuminated either by white light or by light filtered through narrow band filters, allowing only long wavelengths, red, intermediate wavelengths, green, or short wavelengths, blue, to pass. The intensity of the illuminating beam in every case was the same. Mr. I could distinguish most of the geometric shapes, though only as consisting of differing shades of gray, and he instantly ranked them on a 1-4 gray scale, although he could not distinguish some color boundaries, for example, between red and green, which both appeared to him in white light as black. With rapid random switching of the filters, the grayscale value of all the shapes dramatically changed. Some shades previously indistinguishable now became very different, and all shades, except actual black, changed, either grossly or subtly, with the wavelength of the illuminating beam. Thus a green area would be seen by him as white in medium wavelength light, but as black in white or long wavelength light. All Mr. I's responses were consistent and immediate. It would have been very difficult, if not impossible, for a normally sighted person to make these instant and invariably correct estimations, even with a perfect memory and a profound knowledge of the latest color theory. Mr. I, it was clear, could discriminate wavelengths, but he could not go on from this to translate the discriminated wavelengths into color. He could not generate the cerebral or mental construct of color. This finding not only clarified the nature of the problem, but also served to pinpoint the location of the trouble. Mr. I's primary visual cortex was essentially intact, and it was the secondary cortex, specifically the V4 areas, or their connections, that bore virtually the whole brunt of the damage. These areas are very small, even in man. Yet all our perception of color, all our ability to imagine or remember it, all our sense of living in a world of color, depend crucially on their integrity. A mischance had devastated these bean-sized areas of Mr. I's brain, and with this his whole life, his life world, had been changed. The Mondrian testing had demonstrated damage in these areas. We wondered now if we could see this using brain scans. But CAT and MRI scans were entirely normal. This could have been because the scanning techniques of the time had a resolution inadequate to visualize what may have been only a patchy damage to V4. It could have been that the damage sustained was metabolic only, not structural. Or it could have been that the main damage was not in V4 itself, but in the structures, the so-called blobs in V1, or the stripes in V2 leading up to it. It has been stressed by both Zecchi and Francis Crick that these small structures, the blobs and stripes, are intensely active metabolically and may be unusually vulnerable to even temporary reductions of oxygen. Crick, in particular, with whom I discussed the case in great detail, wondered whether Mr. I could have suffered from carbon monoxide poisoning, which is known to cause changes in color vision through its effects on the oxygenation of the blood to the color areas. Mr. I might have been exposed to carbon monoxide through a leaky exhaust in his car, Crick speculated, perhaps due to the accident, conceivably even causing it. Mr. I, fond of spending time in sports clubs and bars, did some research here himself, and told us that he had spoken to a number of boxers who had had transient and sometimes persistent losses of color vision following blows to the head. Partial or total achromatopsia, graying out, also temporary, is characteristic of fainting or shock, in which there is a reduction of blood supply to the posterior and especially the visual parts of the brain. Graying out also occurs in transient ischemic attacks due to arterial insufficiency. Zecchi speculates that this affects the wavelength selective cells in the blobs of V1 and the thin stripes of V2. Transient alterations of color vision, including bizarre instabilities or transformations of color. Dyschromatopsia may also occur in visual migraines and epilepsies and are well known to users of mescaline and other drugs. They can be a disquieting side effect of ibuprofen. But all this was in a sense academic. Mr. I's achromatopsia after 3 months remained absolute, and he had persisting impairments of contrast vision too. Whether these would clear eventually, we could not say. Some cases of acquired cerebral achromatopsia improve with time, but others do not. We still did not know what had caused the damage to Mr. I's brain, whether it was a toxin such as carbon monoxide, or the impact of the car accident, or the result of an impairment of blood flow to the visual areas of the brain. It was possible that if it had been caused by a stroke, there might be more such strokes. The prognosis had to remain uncertain, although his situation by now seemed to be stable. We were, however, able to offer a little practical help. Mr. I had consistently seen the boundaries of the Mondrian patches most clearly when these were illuminated by medium wavelength light, and Dr. Zecchi therefore suggested we give him a pair of green sunglasses, transmitting only this wave band in which he saw most clearly. A pair of glasses was specially made, and Mr. I took to wearing them, especially in bright sunlight. The new glasses delighted him. For although they did nothing to restore his lost color vision, they did seem noticeably to enhance his contrast vision and his perception of form and boundaries. He could even enjoy color TV with his wife again. The dark green glasses in effect rendered the color set monochromatic, though he continued to prefer his old black and white set when alone. The sense of loss following his accident was overwhelming to Jonathan I, as it must be to anyone who loses color. A sense that interweaves itself in all our visual experiences and is so central in our imagination and memory, our knowledge of the world, our culture and art. This sense of loss in relation to the natural world has been remarked upon in every case. For the 19th century physician thrown from his horse, flowers had lost more than half their beauty, and entering his garden, abruptly bereft of color, was not short of shocking. The sense of loss and of shock was doubled and redoubled for Mr. I. For he had not only lost the beauty of the natural world and the world of people, and of the innumerable objects whose colors are part of daily life, but he had also lost the world of art, he felt. The world that, for 50 years or more, had absorbed his profoundly visual and chromatic talents and sensibilities. The first weeks of his achromatopsia were thus weeks of an almost suicidal depression. This sense of loss is not, of course, experienced by those born totally colorblind. This is brought out in another letter I received recently from a charming and intelligent woman, Frances Futterman, born totally colorblind. She contrasted her own situation with that of Jonathan I. I was struck by how different that kind of experience must be, compared to my own experience of never having seen color before, thus never having lost it, and also never having been depressed about my colorless world. The way I see in and of itself is not depressing. In fact, I am frequently overwhelmed by the beauty of the natural world. People say I must see in shades of gray or in black and white, but I don't think so. The word gray has no more meaning for me than the word pink or blue. In fact, even less meaning because I have developed inner concepts of color words like pink and blue. But for the life of me, I can't conceive of gray. Though Mrs. Futterman's experience is certainly different from Mr. I's, both remark on the meaninglessness of the word gray, a word that can no more convey anything to the achromatopic than can darkness to the blind or silence to the deaf. Mrs. Futterman remarks, as Mr. I came to, on the beauty of her world. "I would also be willing to bet," she says, "that if we were tested along with normals and low lighting levels, we would be able to detect far more shades of gray. Black and white photos look far too stark to me. The world I see has so much more richness and variety than black and white photos or TV shows. My vision is a lot richer than normals can imagine." In addition to his sense of loss, Jonathan I found his changed visual world at first abhorrent and abnormal. This, too, is the experience of most people in his position. The concussed physician thrown from his horse found his vision perverted. One of Damasio's patients found her gray world dirty. Why, one must wonder, do all subjects with a cerebral achromatopsia express themselves in such terms? Why should their experience seem so abnormal? Mr. I was seeing with his cones, seeing with the wavelength-sensitive cells of V1, but unable to use the higher-order color-generating mechanism of V4. For us, the output of V1 is unimaginable because it is never experienced as such, and is immediately shunted on to a higher level, where it is further processed to yield the perception of color. Thus, the raw output of V1 never appears in awareness for us. But for Mr. I, it did. His brain damage had made him privy to, indeed, trapped him within a strange in-between state, the uncanny world of V1, a world of anomalous and, so to speak, pre-chromatic sensation, which could not be categorized as either colored or colorless. Mr. I, with his heightened visual and aesthetic sensibilities, found these changes particularly intolerable. We know too little about what determines emotion and aesthetic appeal in relation to color, and indeed in relation to seeing generally, and this is a matter of individual experience and taste. Color perception had been an essential part, not only of Mr. I's visual sense, but his aesthetic sense, his sensibility, his creative identity, an essential part of the way he constructed his world. And now color was gone, not only in perception, but in imagination and memory as well. The resonances of this were very deep. At first he was intensely, furiously conscious of what he had lost, though conscious, so to speak, in the manner of an amnesiac. He would glare at an orange in a state of rage, trying to force it to resume its true color. He would sit for hours before his, to him, dark gray lawn, trying to see it, to imagine it, to remember it as green. He found himself now not only in an impoverished world, but in an alien, incoherent, and almost nightmarish one. He expressed this soon after his injury, better than he could in words in some of his early desperate paintings. But then, with the apocalyptic sunrise and his painting of this, came the first hint of a change, an impulse to construct the world anew, to construct his own sensibility and identity anew. Some of this was conscious and deliberate, retraining his eyes and hands to operate as he had in his first days as an artist. But much occurred below this level, at a level of neural processing not directly accessible to consciousness or control. In this sense, he started to be redefined by what had happened to him, redefined physiologically, psychologically, aesthetically. And with this there came a transformation of values, so that the total otherness, the alienness of his V1 world, which at first had such a quality of horror and nightmare, came to take on for him a strange fascination and beauty. Immediately after his accident, and for a year or more thereafter, Jonathan I insisted that he still knew colors, knew what was right, what was appropriate, what was beautiful, even if he could no longer visualize them in his mind. But thereafter he became somewhat less sure, as if now, unsupported by actual experience or image, his color associations had started to give way. Perhaps such a forgetting at once physiological and psychological, at once strategic and structural, may have to occur to some extent, sooner or later, in anyone who is no longer able to experience or imagine or in any way to generate a particular mode of perception. Nor is it necessary that the primary damage be cortical. It may occur after months or years, even in those who are peripherally or retinally blind. There was a lessening concern with what he had lost, and indeed with the whole subject of color which at first had so obsessed him. Indeed, he now spoke of being divorced from color. He could still speak fluently about it, but there seemed to be a certain hollowness to his words, as if he were drawing only from past knowledge and no longer understood it. Nord B. writes, "Although I have acquired a thorough theoretical knowledge of the physics of colors and the physiology of the color receptor mechanisms, nothing of this can help me to understand the true nature of colors." What was true for Nord B. was now true for Jonathan I. too. He had, in some ways, started to resemble a person born colorblind, even though he had lived in a color world for the first 65 years of his life. At once forgetting and turning away from color, turning away from the chromatic orientation and habits and strategies of his previous life, Mr. I, in the second year after his injury, found that he saw best in subdued light or twilight and not in the full glare of day. Very bright light tended to dazzle and temporarily blind him, another sign of damage to his visual systems. But he found the night and night life peculiarly congenial, for they seemed to be designed, as he once said, in terms of black and white. He started becoming a night person, in his own words, and took to exploring other cities, other places, but only at night. He would drive at random to Boston or Baltimore or to small towns and villages, arriving at dusk, and then wandering about the streets for half the night, occasionally talking to a fellow walker, occasionally going into little diners. Everything in diners is different at night, at least if it has windows. The darkness comes into the place, and no amount of light can change it. They are transformed into night places. I love the nighttime, Mr. I said. Gradually, I am becoming a night person. It's a different world. There's a lot of space. You're not hemmed in by streets, by people. It's a whole new world. Mr. I, when he was not traveling, would get up earlier and earlier to work in the night, to relish the night. He felt that in the night world, as he called it, he was the equal or the superior of normal people. I feel better because I know, then, that I'm not a freak, and I have developed acute night vision. It's amazing what I see. I can read license plates at night from 4 blocks away. You couldn't see it from a block away. One wonders whether his night vision might, with time, have taken on heightened function and compensation for the damage to his color system. There might, at this stage, also have been a heightening of movement sensitivity, perhaps of depth sensitivity, too, possibly going with an increased dependence on and use of the intact M system. Most interesting of all, the sense of profound loss and the sense of unpleasantness and abnormality so severe in the first months following his head injury seemed to disappear or even reverse. Although Mr. I does not deny his loss, and at some level still mourns it, he has come to feel that his vision has become highly refined, privileged that he sees a world of pure form, uncluttered by color. Subtle textures and patterns normally obscured for the rest of us, because of their embedding in color, now stand out for him. He feels he has been given a whole new world, which the rest of us, distracted by color, are insensitive to. He no longer thinks of color, pines for it, grieves its loss. He has almost come to see his achromatopsia as a strange gift, one that has ushered him into a new state of sensibility and being. In this, his transformation is exceedingly similar to that of John Hull, who after 2 or 3 years of experiencing blindness as an affliction and curse, came to see it as a dark, paradoxical gift, a concentrated human condition, one of the orders of human being. Once, about 3 years after his injury, an intriguing suggestion was made by Israel Rosenfield that Mr. I try to regain his color vision. Since the mechanism for comparing wavelengths was intact, and only V4, or its equivalent, was damaged, it might be possible, at least in theory, Rosenfield thought, to retrain another part of the brain to perform the requisite Landian correlations, and thus to achieve some restoration of color vision. What was striking was Mr. I's response to this suggestion. In the first months after his injury, he said he would have embraced such a suggestion, done everything possible to be cured. But now that he conceived the world in different terms and again found it coherent and complete, he thought the suggestion unintelligible and repugnant. Now that color had lost its former associations, its sense, he could no longer imagine what its restoration would be like. Its reintroduction would be grossly confusing, he thought, might force a welter of irrelevant sensations upon him and disrupt the now re-established visual order of his world. He had been for a while in a sort of limbo. Now he had settled, neurologically and psychologically, for the world of achromatopia. In terms of his painting, after a year or more of experiment and uncertainty, Mr. I has moved into a strong and productive phase, as strong and productive as anything in his long artistic career. His black and white paintings are highly successful, and people comment on his creative renewal, the remarkable black and white phase he has moved into. Very few of them know that his latest phase is anything other than an expression of his artistic development, that it was brought about by a calamitous loss. Though it has been possible to define the primary damage in Mr. I's brain, the knocking out of an essential part of his color-constructing system, we are still totally ignorant of the higher changes in brain function that must have occurred in his train. Jonathan I did not lose just his perception of color, but imagery, and even dreaming in color. Finally, he seemed to lose even his memory of color, so that it ceased to be part of his mental knowledge, his mind. Thus, as more and more time elapsed without color vision, he came to resemble someone with an amnesia for color, or indeed someone who had never known it at all. But at the same time, a revision was occurring so that as his former color world and even the memory of it became fainter and died inside him, a whole new world of seeing, of imagination, of sensibility was born. There is no doubt of the reality of these changes, although it may have required a subject as gifted and as articulate as Jonathan I to bring them out with such clarity. Neuroscience at this point can say nothing about the cerebral basis of such higher changes. The physiological investigation of color, thus far, has terminated in the color systems of early vision, the Landian correlations that occur in V1 and V4. But V4 is not an end point. It is only a way station, projecting in its turn to higher and higher levels, eventually to the hippocampus, so essential for the storage of memories, to the emotional centers of the limbic system and amygdala, and to many other parts of the cortex. The cessation of information flow from V4 to the memory systems of the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex, for example, might in part explain Mr. I's forgetting of color. We do not have the tools at the moment to map the subtle, higher-level neural consequences of such a sensory loss, but a history such as Jonathan I's shows how crucial it is to do this. Work in the last decade has shown how plastic the cerebral cortex is, and how the cerebral mapping of body image, for example, may be drastically reorganized and revised, not only following injuries or immobilizations, but in consequence of the special use or disuse of individual parts. We know, for instance, that the constant use of one finger in reading Braille leads to a huge hypertrophy of that finger's representation in the cortex. And with early deafness and the use of sign language, there may be drastic remappings in the brain, large areas of the auditory cortex being reallocated for visual processing. Similarly, it seemed with Mr. I, if entire systems of representation, of meaning, had been extinguished inside him, entirely new systems had been brought into being. On the ultimate question, the question of qualia, why a particular sensation may be perceived as red, the case of Jonathan I may not be able to help us at all. After describing the celebrated phenomenon of colors, Newton drew back from all speculation about sensation and would hazard no hypothesis as to by what modes or action light produceth in our minds the phantasms of colors. 3 centuries later, we still have no hypothesis, and perhaps such questions can never be answered at all. The Last Hippie. Such a long, long time to be gone, and a short time to be there. Robert Hunter, Box of Rain. Greg F. grew up in the 1950s in a comfortable Queens household, an attractive and rather gifted boy who seemed destined, like his father, for a professional career, perhaps a career in songwriting, for which he showed a precocious talent. But he grew restive, started questioning things, as a teenager in the late 60s, started to hate the conventional life of his parents and neighbors and the cynical, bellicose administration of the country. His need to rebel, but equally to find an ideal and a guide, to find a leader, crystallized in the Summer of Love in 1967. He would go to the village and listen to Allen Ginsberg declaiming all night. He loved rock music, especially acid rock, and above all, the the Grateful Dead. Increasingly, he fell out with his parents and teachers. He was truculent with the one, secretive with the other. In 1968, a time when Timothy Leary was urging American youth to tune in, turn on, and drop out, Greg grew his hair long and dropped out of school, where he had been a good student. He left home and went to live in the village, where he dropped acid and joined the East Village drug culture, searching, like others of his generation, for utopia, for inner freedom, and for a higher consciousness. But turning on did not satisfy Greg, who stood in need of a more codified doctrine and way of life. In 1969, he gravitated, as so many young acid heads did, to the Swami Bhaktivedanta and his International Society for Krishna Consciousness on Second Avenue. And under his influence, Greg, like so many others, stopped taking acid, finding his religious exaltation a replacement for acid highs. The only radical remedy for dipsomania, William James once said, is religimania. The philosophy, the fellowship, the chanting, the rituals, the austere and charismatic figure of the Swami himself came like a revelation to Greg, and he became, almost immediately, a passionate devotee and convert. Now there was a center, a focus to his life. In those first exalted weeks of his conversion, he wandered around the East Village dressed in saffron robes, chanting the Hare Krishna mantras, and early in 1970, he took up residence in the main temple in Brooklyn. His parents objected at first, then went along with this. "Perhaps it will help him," his father said philosophically. "Perhaps, who knows, this is the path he needs to follow." Greg's first year at the temple went well. He was obedient, ingenuous, devoted, and pious. "He is a holy one," said the Swami, "one of us." Early in 1971, now deeply committed, Greg was sent to the temple in New Orleans. His parents had seen him occasionally when he was in the Brooklyn temple, but now communication from him virtually ceased. One problem arose in Greg's second year with the Krishnas. He complained that his vision was growing dim, but this was interpreted by his Swami and others in a spiritual way. He was an illuminate, they told him. It was the inner light growing. Greg had worried at first about his eyesight, but was reassured by the Swami's spiritual explanation. His sight grew still dimmer, but he offered no further complaints, and indeed he seemed to be becoming more spiritual by the day. An amazing new serenity had taken hold of him. He no longer showed his previous impatience or appetites, and he was sometimes found in a sort of daze with a strange, some said, transcendental smile on his face. "It is beatitude," said his Swami. "He is becoming a saint." The temple felt he needed to be protected at this stage. He no longer went out or did anything unaccompanied, and contact with the outside world was strongly discouraged. Although Greg's parents did not have any direct communication from him, they did get occasional reports from the temple, reports filled increasingly with accounts of his spiritual progress, his enlightenment, accounts at once so vague and so out of character with the Greg they knew that by degrees they became alarmed. Once they wrote directly to the Swami and received a soothing, reassuring reply. 3 more years passed before Greg's parents decided they had to see for themselves. His father was by then in poor health and feared that if he waited longer, he might never see his lost son again. On hearing this, the temple finally permitted a visit from Greg's parents. In 1975, then, not having seen him for 4 years, they visited their son in the temple in New Orleans. When they did so, they were filled with horror. Their lean, hairy son had become fat and hairless. He wore a continual stupid smile on his face. This at least was his father's word for it. He kept bursting into bits of song and verse and making idiotic comments, while showing little deep emotion of any kind. Like he was scooped out, hollow inside, his father said. He had lost interest in everything current. He was disoriented, and he was totally blind. The temple, surprisingly, acceded to his leaving. Perhaps even they felt now that his ascension had gone too far, and started to feel some disquiet about his state. Greg was admitted to the hospital, examined, and transferred to neurosurgery. Brain imaging had shown an enormous midline tumor, destroying the pituitary gland and the adjacent optic chiasm and tracts, and extending on both sides into the frontal lobes. It also reached backward to the temporal lobes, and downward to the diencephalon, or forebrain. At surgery, the tumor was found to be benign, a meningioma. But it had swollen to the size of a small grapefruit or orange, and though the surgeons were able to remove it almost entirely, they could not undo the damage it had already done. Greg was now not only blind, but gravely disabled neurologically and mentally, a disaster that could have been prevented entirely had his first complaints of dimming vision been heeded, and had medical sense and even common sense been allowed to judge his state. Since tragically no recovery could be expected, or very little, Greg was admitted to Williamsbridge, a hospital for the chronically sick. A 25-year-old boy for whom active life had come to an end, and for whom the prognosis was considered hopeless. I first met Greg in April 1977, when he arrived at Williamsbridge Hospital. Lacking facial hair and childlike in manner, he seemed younger than his 25 years. He was fat, Buddha-like, with a vacant, bland face, his blind eyes roving at random in their orbits, while he sat motionless in his wheelchair. If he lacked spontaneity and initiated no exchanges, he responded promptly and appropriately when I spoke to him, though odd words would sometimes catch his fancy and give rise to associative tangents or snatches of song and rhyme. Between questions at the time was not filled, there tended to be a deepening silence, though if this lasted for more than a minute, he might fall into Hare Krishna chants or a soft muttering of mantras. He was still, he said, a total believer, devoted to the group's doctrines and aims. I could not get any consecutive history from him. He was not sure, for a start, why he was in the hospital and gave different reasons when I asked him about this. First, he said, because I'm not intelligent. Later, because I took drugs in the past. He knew he had been at the main Hare Krishna temple, a big red house, 439 Henry Street in Brooklyn. But not that he had subsequently been at their temple in New Orleans. Nor did he remember that he started to have symptoms there, first and foremost a progressive loss of vision. Indeed, he seemed unaware that he had any problems, that he was blind, that he was unable to walk steadily, that he was in any way ill. Unaware and indifferent. He seemed bland, placid, emptied of all feeling. It was this unnatural serenity that his Krishna brethren had perceived apparently as bliss, and indeed at one point Greg used the term himself. How do you feel? I returned to this again and again. I feel blissful, he replied at one point. I am afraid of falling back into the material world. At this point, when he was first in the hospital, many of his Hare Krishna friends would come to visit him. I often saw their saffron robes in the corridors. They would come to visit poor blind blank Greg and flock around him. They saw him as having achieved detachment, as an enlightened one. Questioning him about current events and people, I found the depths of his disorientation and confusion. When I asked him who was the president, he said Lyndon, then the one who got shot. I prompted, Jimmy, and he said, Jimi Hendrix. And when I roared with laughter, he said maybe a musical White House would be a good idea. A few more questions convinced me that Greg had virtually no memory of events much past 1970. Certainly no coherent chronological memory of them. He seemed to have been left marooned in the 60s. His memory, his development, his inner life since then had come to a stop. His tumor, a slow-growing one, was huge when it was finally removed in 1976, but only in the later stages of its growth, as it destroyed the memory system in the temporal lobe, would it actually have prevented the brain from registering new events. But Greg had difficulties, not absolute, but partial, even in remembering events from the late 60s, events that he must have registered perfectly at the time. So beyond the inability to register new experiences, there had been an erosion of existing memories, a retrograde amnesia, going back several years before his tumor had developed. There was not an absolutely sharp cutoff here, but rather a temporal gradient, so that figures and events from 1966 and 1967 were fully remembered, events from 1968 or 1969 partially or occasionally remembered, and events after 1970 almost never remembered. It was easy to demonstrate the severity of his immediate amnesia. If I gave him lists of words, he was unable to recall any of them after a minute. When I told him a story and asked him to repeat it, he did so in a more and more confused way, with more and more contaminations and misassociations, some droll, some extremely bizarre, until within 5 minutes his story bore no resemblance to the one I had told him. Thus, when I told him a tale about a lion and a mouse, he soon departed from the original story and had the mouse threatening to eat the lion. It had become a giant mouse and a mini lion. Both were mutants, Greg explained when I quizzed him on his departures. Or possibly he said they were creatures from a dream, or an alternative history, in which mice were indeed the lords of the jungle. 5 minutes later, he had no memory of the story whatever. I had heard from the hospital social worker that he had a passion for music, especially for rock and roll bands of the 60s. I saw piles of records as soon as I entered his room, and a guitar lying against his bed. So now I asked him about this, and with this, there came a complete transformation. He lost his disconnectedness, his indifference, and spoke with great animation about his favorite rock bands and pieces, above all of the Grateful Dead. I went to see them at the Fillmore East and in Central Park, he said. He remembered the entire program in detail. But my favorite, he added, is Tobacco Road. The title evoked the tune, and Greg sang the whole song with great feeling and conviction, a depth of feeling of which hitherto he had not shown the least sign. He seemed transformed, a different person, a whole person as he sang. When did you hear them in Central Park? I asked. It's been a while, over a year maybe, he answered. But, in fact, they had last played there 8 years earlier, in 1969. And the Fillmore East, the famous rock and roll theater where Greg had also seen the group, did not survive the early 1970s. He went on to tell me he once heard Jimi Hendrix at Hunter College, and Cream, with Jack Bruce playing bass guitar, Eric Clapton lead guitar, and Ginger Baker, a fantastic drummer. Jimi Hendrix, he added reflectively. What's he doing? Don't hear much about him nowadays. We spoke of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. Great groups, Greg commented. But they don't space me out the way the Dead do. What a group, he continued. There's no one like them. Jerry Garcia, he's a saint. He's a guru. He's a genius. Mickey Hart, Bill Kreutzmann, the drummers are great. There's Bob Weir, there's Phil Lesh, but Pigpen, I love him. This narrowed down the extent of his amnesia. He remembered songs vividly from 1964 to 1968. He remembered all the founding members of the Grateful Dead, from 1967. But he was unaware that Pigpen, Jimi Hendrix, and Janis Joplin were all dead. His memory cut off by 1970 or before. He was caught in the 60s, unable to move on. He was a fossil, the last hippie. At first, I did not want to confront Greg with the enormity of his time loss, his amnesia, or even to let involuntary hints through, which he would certainly pick up, for he was very sensitive to anomaly and tone. So I changed the subject and said, "Let me examine you." He was, I noted, somewhat weak and spastic in all his limbs, more on the left and more in the legs. He could not stand alone. His eyes showed complete optic atrophy. It was impossible for him to see anything. But strangely, he did not seem to be aware of being blind, and would guess that I was showing him a blue ball, a red pen, when in fact it was a green comb and a fob watch that I showed him. Nor indeed did he seem to look. He made no special effort to turn in my direction, and when we were speaking, he often failed to face me, to look at me. When I asked him about seeing, he acknowledged that his eyes weren't all that good, but added that he enjoyed watching the TV. Watching TV for him, I observed later, consisted of following with attention the soundtrack of a movie or show, and inventing visual scenes to go with it, even though he might not even be looking toward the TV. He seemed to think, indeed, that this was what seeing meant, that this was what was meant by watching TV, and that this was what all of us did. Perhaps he had lost the very idea of seeing. I found this aspect of Greg's blindness, his singular blindness to his blindness, his no longer knowing what seeing or looking meant, deeply perplexing. It seemed to point to something stranger and more complex than a mere deficit, to point rather to some radical alteration within him in the very structure of knowledge, in consciousness, in identity itself. I had already had some sense of this when testing his memory, finding his confinement in effect to a single moment, the present, uninformed by any sense of a past or a future. Given this radical lack of connection and continuity in his inner life, I got the feeling indeed that he might not have an inner life to speak of, that he lacked the constant dialogue of past and present, of experience and meaning, which constitutes consciousness and inner life for the rest of us. He seemed to have no sense of next, and to lack that eager and anxious tension of anticipation, of intention that normally drives us through life. Some sense of ongoing, of next, is always with us. But this sense of movement, of happening, Greg lacked. He seemed immured, without knowing it, in a motionless, timeless moment. And whereas for the rest of us the present is given its meaning and depth by the past, hence it becomes the remembered present, in Gerald Edelman's term, as well as being given potential and tension by the future, for Greg it was flat, and in its meager way, complete. This living in the moment, which was so manifestly pathological, had been perceived in the temple as an achievement of higher consciousness. Greg seemed to adjust to Williamsbridge with remarkable ease, considering he was a young man being placed, probably forever, in a hospital for the chronically ill. There was no furious defiance, no railing at fate, no sense, apparently, of indignity or despair. Compliantly, indifferently, Greg let himself be put away in the backwater of Williamsbridge. When I asked him about this, he said, "I have no choice." And this, as he said it, seemed wise and true. Indeed, he seemed eminently philosophical about it. But it was a philosophicalness made possible by his indifference, his brain damage. His parents, so estranged from him when he was rebellious and well, came daily, doted on him, now that he was helpless and ill. And they, for their part, could be sure at any time that he would be at the hospital, smiling and grateful for their visit. If he was not waiting for them, so much the better. They could miss a day or a few days if they were away. He would not notice, but would be cordial as ever the next time they came. Greg soon settled in with his rock records and his guitar, his Hare Krishna beads, his talking books, and a schedule of programs, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, music groups, drama. Soon after admission, he was moved to a ward with younger patients, where with his open and sunny personality, he became popular. He did not actually know any of the other patients or the staff, at least for several months, but was invariably, if indiscriminately, pleasant to them all. And there were at least two special friendships, not intense, but with a sort of complete acceptance and stability. His mother remembers Eddie, who had MS. They both loved music. They had adjacent rooms. They used to sit together. And Judy, she had CP. She would sit for hours with them, too. Eddie died, and Judy went to a hospital in Brooklyn. There has been no one so close for many years. Mrs. F. remembers them, but Greg does not, never asked for them or about them, after they had gone. Though perhaps his mother thought he was sadder, at least less lively, for they stimulated him, got him talking and listening to records and inventing limericks, joking and singing. They pulled him out of that dead state he would otherwise fall into. A hospital for the chronically ill where patients and staff live together for years is a little like a village or a small town. Everybody gets to meet to know everybody else. I often saw Greg in the corridors being wheeled to different programs or out to the patio in his wheelchair with the same odd, blind, yet searching look on his face. And he gradually got to know me, at least sufficiently to know my name, to ask each time we met, "How are you doing, Dr. Sachs? When's the next book coming out?" A question that rather distressed me in the seemingly endless 11-year interim between the publication of Awakenings and A Leg to Stand On. Names, then, he might learn with frequent contact, and in relation to them he would recollect a few details about each new person. Thus he came to know Connie Tomeno, the music therapist. He would recognize her voice, her footfalls, immediately. But he could never remember where or how he had met her. One day Greg began talking about another Connie, a girl called Connie, whom he'd known in high school. This other Connie, he told us, was also remarkably very musical. "How come all you Connies are so musical?" he teased. The other Connie would conduct music groups, he said, would give out song sheets, play the piano accordion, and sing songs at school. At this point, it started to dawn on us that this other Connie was, in fact, Connie herself, and this was clinched when he added, "You know, she played the trumpet, too." Connie Tomeno is a professional trumpet player. This sort of thing often happened with Greg when he put things into the wrong context or failed to connect them with the present. His sense of there being two Connies, his segmenting Connie into two, was characteristic of the bewilderments he sometimes found himself in, his need to hypothesize additional figures because he could not retain or conceive of an identity in time. With consistent repetition, Greg might learn a few facts, and these would be retained. But the facts were isolated, denuded of context. A person, a voice, a place would slowly become familiar, but he remained unable to remember where he had met the person, heard the voice, seen the place. Specifically,